So this morning I'm going to continue the theme that I was... Hi. Good to see you. That I was working on in my last talk, which was probably 3 weeks ago, which is the theme of breaking through our conditioning. It's a familiar Zen theme, right? Breaking through our conditioning. Breaking through the continual way in which our life is propelled by our memories, by our fears, by our anger, by our concern, by our wanting to be different. And the 12-fold chain of dependent origination, and Buddhism goes around and around and around, around and around and around. But through the practice of meditation, through the practice of bare awareness, bare attention, shikantaza, whatever you call it, there's a possibility to experience some gaps in that chain. And in particular, as I was saying last time, between the ninth and the tenth link in the chain. And let me give you examples from my own life. Why not? Why not? I have two grandchildren staying with me for 4 weeks, a one-year-old and a four-year-old. And their parents have fled to another part of the United States. So actually, I just left my wife. I got up really early. I said, Linda, I'm not going to work on my talk this morning. I'll just be there for the kids. But then I had to flee. Anyway, so earlier in the week, I wanted to take. Let me go through this chain. So earlier in the week, I was there in the morning with my two grandsons. My wife was taking a rest. We have to take rests. My wife was taking a rest, and I looked out the door, and it was nice out. It was nice out. It wasn't too hot. There were a few clouds in the sky. It was nice. So I had a pleasant sensation, a pleasant feeling. That's the eighth link in the chain, a pleasant sensation, a pleasant feeling. So then I said, let's go, boys. And my four-year-old grandson didn't have very much to do to get ready, but he came up with all kinds of things he had to do to get ready. All kinds of things. He suddenly had to go play with his train, and then he wanted to bring his train with him. And then his tanks, he wanted to bring them with him. And meanwhile, I was getting the one-year-old dressed to go outside, which is mostly undressed, right? But with a lot of water, with snacks, getting out the stroller. Our goal is to make it from Fremont to the lake. We can make it to Fremont to the lake. We're having a good time, right? That's where I live in Fremont. So I have my positive sensation feeling, and then I have my intention and my emotion that follows after that, which is, why? We can go outside. My intention to move them along, and the emotional valence that's attached to that intention, in this case, is positive valence. But it takes my four-year-old 30 minutes to get ready. 30 minutes to get ready. And by the time he's ready, what's happened? I look outside, I hear thunder. And so we're not going outside. So I look outside, I have an unpleasant sensation. I have an unpleasant feeling. And then I have an intention to stay in, and there's a negative emotional valence. There's, oh shit, I have to stay in with these kids. And furthermore, this four-year-old has thwarted my our nice time together. Of course, it would have only lasted for 30 minutes if we'd all been rained on. But you know, the mind is not rational when it's going through this chain. So that happened to me. Okay, so there's the possibility in our zazen. I mean, why do we do meditation at all? We do meditation so we can recognize how we do these things, how we move so quickly, it's like automatons, from the sensation to the emotion to the action. We can recognize and we can accept. If we can fully accept, we begin to break the links in the chain. We begin to break down the automatic, mindless kind of activity that goes over and over again. And so there's always that possibility. But if you don't have a sitting practice, it's hard for you to do it in the world. I'll tell you, it's hard to do it in the world with a sitting practice. But without a sitting practice, I say forget it. Forget it. Because your mind is too fast. You're too revved up by all of your unconscious emotions and all of your impulses. With a sitting practice, you always have that opportunity. I always have that opportunity to see a gap, to experience a gap between the links. There is a gap there. There is a gap there. So that I don't have to follow the same sequence over and over again of sensation to feeling to emotion to action and be a prisoner of the past. So that every time I see my 4-year-old, no, I don't have to think, oh, God, how long is it going to take? I can just see him. I can just be with him. But I can notice those. I can notice the negative emotions and feelings coming up. I have to notice them. If I don't notice them, there's no chance to be free from them. So the possibility of space between emotional intention and action. And action can include action of the mind. It can include repression, and that's action. It can include suppression, that's action. But the gap between the two breaks the whole chain. Now, how long does it break it for? Well, don't worry about it. If you think how long, then you're back in the chain, trying to get somewhere. And you're just getting the chain all revved up. It breaks it. If there's full awareness, if there's full participation in whatever is. So another example from my own life. So about a week ago, is in my other job, I have I direct a nonprofit agency, and I have I hired recently a couple of really competent people to be my lieutenants, to really manage things and run things. And it's been a surprise, their competency, and mostly just wonderful. But here's an example. So I walked into a meeting that they were having, my two lieutenants were having with the senior staff, and when I walked in, nobody noticed me. I was not noticed because my lieutenants were, you know, doing their thing, right? They were, and everybody was involved with them. And I was not noticed. So I walked in, I had an unpleasant sensation. I had an unpleasant feeling, right? It's human nature. I don't care how many years you meditate, it's human nature. And then, after that, the intention, the emotion. Well, what was it? Well, it was kind of two. One, withdraw, feeling left out, or maybe wanted to make some statement. Come in and say something cool, something inspiring. And that was pretty confusing. And those were the actions. Now, is it possible at that point just to stop, just to fully accept my feeling left out? That's not very far from returning to zero, is it? I always tell you to return to zero. Well, feeling left out, if you really feel it, is that any different than returning to zero? It's fine for me to tell it to you. Can I really experience being left out, so left out, that there's nothing to worry about? There's nothing to compare? There's nothing to evaluate? that left out that I'm completely left in? That left out? Isn't that what Buddhism is all about? I think so. I think so. So even if we want to act, sometimes we need to act. It's better to wait until the neediness passes. If you're practicing, when you're practicing bare awareness. Now there are times you're just going to lose it. But if you're practicing bare awareness, it's better to wait until the neediness, the desperate neediness passes, and be with the desperate neediness. Is that possible? Sure, it's possible. Sure, it's what's happening. It's always possible you're what's happening. So, and that weakens the link. That weakens the whole chain. That opens a realm of deconditioning, of openness, of being present in the world. So here's some research by a neurosurgeon named Benjamin Libet, which I'm going to read to you. Benjamin Libet, a neurosurgeon, made a dramatic discovery that points to the power of breaking the chain, and suggests just why bare awareness can be such a powerful method of bringing intelligence to our emotional lives. Because the brain has no nerve endings and so feels no pain, and because neurosurgeons need to be sure they have not inadvertently strayed into the wrong area of the brain, patients do not get a full anesthesia during brain surgery, but remain awake and aware. Did you know that? I didn't know that. Oh, wow. This allows them to speak or move a part of the body to let the surgeon know that all is well. Taking advantage of this unusual opportunity, Dr. Libet did a simple experiment. He would ask patients during surgery to move their finger. He used an ingenious clock face that tracked time in thousands of a second, allowing the patients to note the time with extraordinary accuracy. This way, they could report the precise moment when they became aware of the urge to move the finger. Meanwhile, Dr. Libet was also monitoring the electrical activity in the part of the patient's brain that regulated movement of the finger. This let him see when the brain actually began activity that would culminate in the movement. In short, it let him separate the moment of intent to move from the moment of awareness of that intent from the moment of actual action. All this allowed the remarkable discovery that the part of the brain that regulates movement began its activity a quarter of a second before people became aware of the intent to move the finger. In other words, the brain begins to activate an impulse prior to the dawning in our awareness of the intent to make that very action. And now here's the part that I think is really relevant to our practice. Once the person is aware of the intent to move, Ubat discovered, there is another quarter second before the movement begins. The window is crucial. It is the moment when we have the capacity to go along with the impulse or not go along with it. The will, one could say, resides here in this quarter second. This window offers us the chance to break the chain or blindly follow it. Well, that's kind of interesting. So we have a quarter second. But we continually have quarter seconds. So even if we miss the last thousand quarter seconds, here's another one. We don't have to live as automatons. We don't have to live mindlessly. When we're angry, we don't have to just respond in our normal angry way, whether it's repression or striking out. When we're afraid, we don't have to do our pattern. Each of us has our own patterns, right? What we learned them a long time ago, and we got into this groove and more into this groove, and then we don't even know we're in this groove anymore. It just becomes our life. It takes over our life. So, in a way, meditation, zazen, bare awareness, is about the power not to act. Power not to act. It's not the power to say no. That's repression, right? Because saying no is acting. It's suppressing or repressing. It's the power not to act. It to access that gap, that quarter second gap between intention and action. And that quarter second gap is huge, huge. So we have a choice in our lives to do this kind of practice, and we do it here in the meditation hall, and we do it out in the community, or to just let emotional charges govern our lives. And many of us are a lot more tamped down. We don't look like we have emotional charges because we do it in an Anglo-Saxon kind of way. But it's still the same. It's still the same. Instead of charging out, we're charging in. We're charging in. We're hurting our organs. We're hurting our body. We're holding it all together. This is not about holding it all together. It's about just being with it, fully with it, recognizing it and accepting it, whatever it is, whatever it is. Turning that magic quarter second, turning that magic quarter second into mindfulness precision of what's going on right now. So we do walking meditation here. Next time you do walking meditation, try this in a conscious way. It would be cool. It would be interesting. Try it in a conscious way. When we do walking meditation, we're in the room or outside. We're going around the room, and notice when you have the intention to lift your foot. Then notice when you lift it. Notice when you have the intention to put down your foot. Then notice when you put it down. And then when you get to the corner, when we get to the corner, we turn. And people always ask me, well, how am I supposed to turn when I get to that corner? Well, I don't know how you're supposed to turn. But notice the intention to turn. And then notice when you're actually doing it. Then finally, the meditation is over and the bell rings. Notice the intention to stop. Notice the stopping. There's a gap. There's a gap. And the slower your mind becomes, the more grounded in just this, the more there's an appreciation of those gaps. Without trying to get more of them. You don't have to get more of them because they're happening continually. And it's okay if you miss them because there's always another one. So I think, as most of you guys know, I've been practicing meditation for a long time, and I've practiced with a lot of people, and I've seen a lot of people come and go, do meditation for a while, and then get discouraged, and then quit, and then come back, and then try one kind of meditation and another. And we did this survey of our stakeholders a while ago. We had this person come in, and I was told that meditation is very hard. I was told that that's the problem. Meditation is very hard. I guess it's very hard. If you think about it in terms of accomplishing stuff, it's very hard. But this simple process is not that hard. It's not that hard. Does it sound hard? It's really not. I think it's hard for us in Western culture, maybe in Eastern culture too, but this is the only culture I know. I think it's hard primarily for two reasons. One is we get impatient. We get impatient. And another is that so many of us feel some kind of underlying unworthiness. We're just not good enough. We'll never really do it. We do it for a while, it works for a while, but Katagiri Roshi used to say, I don't understand you Americans. So much emotional problem. He said, where did you get all this emotional problem? He said, look what you have. You've got the lake, you've got all this land, you've got all this beauty, you've got nature. You have so much emotional problem. Fundamentally, as a people, as an immigrant people, we seem to have unworthiness. We seem to be on our guard. We seem to feel not okay. Now, of course, I'm generalizing, right? I'm generalizing. But Dalai Lama said the same thing. He said, oh, what did he say? I wrote it down. He said, oh, the self-loathing, feeling of not being good, you have. Where did you get that? Where did you get that? Not from Buddha. So our feeling of unworthiness. Or some of us don't have. I don't have feelings of unworthiness. I have feelings of performance-based worthiness. So I learned really young that I was worthy. I was the best. All I had to do was keep performing to show it. But I'll tell you, performance-based worthiness ain't any better. It ain't any better. In some ways, it's worse. But I won't get into that. So I think because of that, we get really discouraged in this practice. This practice doesn't give us very much. It doesn't give us a God. It doesn't give us bliss. It just gives us these moments. And these moments are beautiful, but then we want more of them and we don't get enough of them. And the retreat was too long or too short. Our sitting posture was too rigid or too loose. And so we have a continual frustration. And, of course, this is hard because the central thesis of Buddhism is that we're all connected. And when you're feeling unworthy, you don't feel connected. You don't feel connected to your body. You don't feel connected to the people around you. You don't feel connected to the earth. You don't feel connected to the sky. You don't feel connected to your culture. So this degree of loathing comes when we practice bare awareness. It comes because it's here already. It comes up. And that's another reason we quit. If we think, oh, shit, excuse me, but maybe I should be doing something else. At least if I do Tai Chi, you know, I'll be flowing. You know, I move my body. I'll feel like I'm worth something. I mean, sitting facing the wall, noticing. I mean, what's that? What's that? Well, it is the door to freedom. And not the only door, but a door to freedom. Sure, there are other doors, but it's a door to freedom. We can feel the rawness right in that sensation and that intention, the rawness of the discomfort, the rawness of the unworthiness. Instead of covering it over with shame and saying, oh, I'm not going to sit anymore. This is sitting. I should be in therapy full time instead. We can just feel it. Shame, etymologically, means to cover up. We cover up because we feel ashamed of our unworthiness. So we put on a good face, sitting in the zendo, looking pretty straight, not falling asleep, at least trying not to fall asleep, looking like our minds are nice and calm, even though they're racing 180,000 miles an hour. And can we see all that in our bare awareness? Can we just see that? Can we experience that without doing anything about it? Without needing even to perform. And people can spend years meditating, and still keep this stuff suppressed. You know, you have a good posture, you get ordained, you wear the robes, you learn the vocabulary, you learn how to breathe kind of deeply for a while, but we're not really doing it. We're not authentic. This is about becoming authentic. authentically present with what is. With what is. And of course, what we do is, what we did in late 20th century America, and we're doing to a less degree in 21st century America, is we get drawn into idealistic cosmologies to help our pain, to help our unworthiness. Who's the guru? Who's the Zen master? Who's the one who's going to give it to me? If I just sit with him for so many years, or so many days, or so many minutes, if I just go to this fundamentalist church, whether it be Buddhist or Christian, and get saved, all I need to do is get saved. All I need to do is get enlightened. Yeah, right. Right. It's your delusion. It's your delusion. Because you feel not okay. And it's a better delusion than drugs and alcohol. It's a healthier delusion. Sure. It's a healthier delusion than self-judgment over and over and over again. But how much healthier is it? Maybe not, because after a while you crash. After a while you crash. So this practice of meditation, this practice of bare awareness, is really spiritual parenting. Spiritual parenting. We have not been connected. At that point that I was with my grandson on the 31st minute, when I looked out and I saw the rain, I was not connected. But there he was. He was alive with his little bathing suit on and his pail and his two tanks and his two squirt guns. You know, it's all weapons and guns, and which I hate, but there it is. There it is. He was alive. The life is always there. The connection is always there, whether it's a grandson or a dog or a cat or a worm. If we just come back, there's the gap. And the gap is huge. It only lasts a quarter second. It doesn't matter. You need more than that. So this is a deconditioning process that we're going through if we have a commitment to a meditation process. We're deconditioning the habit of turning against ourselves or trying to promote ourselves. Deconditioning that. The historical Buddha said, our fear is great, but greater yet is the truth of our connectedness. Right? The truth of our connectedness. So we're no longer compelled to blame. We're no longer compelled to hide. We're no longer compelled to fix or to find out how to do it better. I want to figure out how to do meditation better. We'll miss our quarter seconds forever if we're trying to do it better. Don't you think? So the other I think major impediment, other than unworthiness, to really integrating this practice of bare awareness into our lives, not just these four walls but our lives, is patience. We're not very patient, and again, this is a thing that people in the culture think is a little weird about us. When I was in India, you know, they're just used to waiting in lines for 5 hours. And I'm on the freeway coming home from work, and there are four cars in front of me blocking my way. And I want to get home. But I could just get around those four cars. Oh, well, what would I be? I'd be home 8 seconds earlier, right? How many people do that? How many people do that? It's amazing. It's a trip, isn't it? It's a trip. We don't like to wait. We came into this country as pioneers. We conquered nature. We learned to live with it. We we became very productive agriculturally. We built cities. We did that by not waiting. We did that by doing, by doing, by doing, by doing. Bear awareness is about waiting, you guys. It's about waiting. Bear awareness can be practiced in line at the grocery store, at rush hour, coming from St. Paul to Minneapolis, waiting to get into the baseball game. That's anywhere you are, where you're impatient. If you're impatient, there's a chance to practice. It will be hard for you, probably, because there's a lot of other stuff going on, a lot of stimulation. So I believe if you don't have a sitting practice already by yourself, it will be almost impossible. But if you have a sitting practice with others or here or by yourself, then you can begin to do this. You can begin to do this. And you can begin to see how impatient you are. So, I did read someplace that the average American spends a month waiting in a 10-year period. And I don't know who did the research on this, but a month of waiting. So there's a month of a chance to practice bear awareness. Wow, that's a whole month. That's a month retreat during 10 years. You say, oh, I don't have time to do retreats. You're too impatient to do retreats. Well, you're doing a month of waiting for something, so that's pretty cool, isn't it? Take that opportunity. Why not? It's your life. Why not? But we don't have patience. And so after doing it for a few months or a few years, we fall off and we say, oh, I'm not going to do this meditation anymore. I'm going to do something else. And to encourage ourselves, sometimes we need to repeat something to ourselves. We need to repeat to ourselves any little kind of slogan that will help you. I mean, after all, central teaching of Buddhism, everything changing. So you can always say when you're waiting in line and the line isn't moving at all, this too will pass. It's going to pass. The line is going to move. You can always say to yourself, what really matters? Does it really matter that I get these groceries by 6 o'clock so I can be home at 6:30? So much so that I'm going to sit here fretting in line? Or does it matter that I have a chance just to notice the vegetables in my cart? Notice the affect of the person in front of me and behind me. Notice my own anxiety about wanting to be home with my wife so that I can show her I'm a good boy after 40 number years or whatever it is. Right? Just notice it. There's whole being Buddha nature. Just noticing. Nothing else. Nothing else. So, the meditation teacher, Tara, let's see if I can remember her name. I think it's...
Brock.
Brock, good. Meditation teacher Tara Brock, reported in one of her books that at the end of a retreat, after she talked about the work of this guy, this neurosurgeon, she talked about it during the retreat every day for 7 days. Well, you know, that's what retreats are like, right? And then at the end of the retreat, one of the students said to her, I didn't realize I had so much time in that quarter second. And she was delighted. That quarter second before I react. And another student said, geez, I'm catching more quarter seconds in my life. Now, I don't know about catching them, because I think as soon as you're into catching them, you're going to get really impatient and you're going to rev up the chain. So I think I would like to hang out with that student a little more. But I think you get what I mean. So that's what I want to say for today. Questions? Comments? Yeah.
So would you talk about in the Eightfold Path, right action and right speech?
Yeah.
And it seems like already, like when you think of right action, you think of doing, but you're saying the power not to act.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that is more where the opportunity of right action and right speech is because we're so weighed down with habit energy that most of the time we're doing just impulsive behavior that is, you know, oftentimes inappropriate to the situation?
That's right, but let's not, I agree with you completely, but let's not take it to an extreme. If we can go into that quarter second gap, really be with it, then we have choice to act or not to act. Maybe we do need to act assertively, but we're not going to be acting reactively. There may be a little bit of reactivity, but the more we get into the gap, the less reactivity there'll be, and there'll be a choice to act or not to act. Because action is important, and of course in Zen, there's this huge emphasis on spontaneous action, which we often get confused with impulsive action, and really they're never the twain shall meet. Impulsive, spontaneous action really only comes out of this practice of bare attention over and over and over again, so that then the action is fully in the moment, fully of the moment. But I think we need to be careful about not turning this into a religion of inaction. There's a lot that needs to be done. There are a lot of people suffering. And we're bodhisattvas, aren't we? Yeah. Good question, or good comment. Yeah.
And it may be in that quarter second you discover a different action.
That's right. A different action. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can say inaction is another form of action, but let's not think about words here. Let's just think about coming back rather than action or inaction. Oh. Oh, okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. That's right. Well, it's just that Buddhism. So this is an analogy that whenever I talk about these analogies between science and Buddhism, I get in trouble because I know nothing about science. I know a lot about Buddhism and nothing about science. So I have to be very careful here. This is the way Buddhists describe it, and this neurosurgeon said something that sounded very, very similar. That's all I can say. When I read it, I thought, wow. Wow. I mean, I never thought of a quarter of a second before, but I noticed how fast it all happens. How, when I'm doing my walking meditation, how slow I really have to be to notice the intent before the leg lifts. How focused and present I have to be. Yeah, that's right. And of course, forgetting brain physiology, because I don't know anything about it. In Buddhism, intention and emotion are totally linked together. Emotion is a valence of intention. Each intention has a valence. My intention to positive intention to reach out to you, there's a positive valence or negative valence. Then there are neutral valences too. That's just when I'm not connected or disconnected. I'm just ignoring. But that's probably more than you want to know. So. Yeah.
I hear you said on the way that scientists can obviously reduce the consciousness of physical stuff that's the school of thought, but that kind of solve the brain problem. You know, and they talk about it in a Buddhist sense of like, here's all these movements arising, and they're constantly you can look at it from the interior or the exterior. And so, and then third school of thought, just reduce everything to it's just all this physical thing happening.
Mm-hmm.
And the other schools that will call it this, that they're rising together. So the mind is arising within the brain. And they're in vocals, you know, they the thought of the brain, these secrets, thoughts. Well, yeah, that's looking at from that exterior view.
Well, that's interesting. That's interesting. Pardon? Yeah. Uchiyama Roshi talked about that. But he didn't know anything about brain science either. So we should be, us Zen teachers need to be careful about this stuff, unless we've really immersed ourselves in it. I know. Well, I'm using it as a metaphor, too. Can I get away with that? Yeah.
You were saying that emotion and intention are linked.
Actually, they're this. Each emotion is an intent. It has an intentionality.
Sorry, I guess I'm wondering: is you talked today about the gap between intention and action?
Right.
Is there a gap before intention?
Yes. The way this chain goes. Those of you, some of you studied it with me. Okay, so the chain. So first, I make contact. This is number 7 in the chain. I make contact. I look at the weather. That's my contact with the weather. Then number 8 is my feeling sensation, looking out the door of pleasant. Wow, pleasant. Then number 9 is my emotion intention. I'd like to do that. You know, it's positive. It's got a positive valence. And there's my action. So, but now I lost your question. I think
my question was: can you focus on are there gaps?
Yes,
all the way along the way?
There are gaps along the way, but. And it's possible to break the link between 8 and 9, but very, very difficult. This is breaking the link between 9 and 10 through noticing the gap. But it's possible, supposedly, for me to look out, say I've just been in retreat for 32 weeks or something. I don't know, I'm just making this up, right? 32 days, 32 minutes, but I've really been. I'm looking out the window. I see pleasant. I have a pleasant sensation. I have a pleasant feeling, and there's a gap before intention, emotion. There's no emotion that comes up. There's no intention. I'm just there with it. I'm just in samadhi with it. And of course, some people would say that that's a form of enlightenment. But you can say anything is enlightenment. But that's a harder one, I think, for most people. It's harder because you really have to be slow for that one. The emotion comes, kicks in so fast. The intention kicks in so fast. The other links, they say you can't break. So you can break between 9 and 10, or if you're really good, between 8 and 9. That's what they say. Well, try it. See what happens. And see, actually, you are trying it when you're practicing meditation. In Zen, we don't do this consciously. We just do the meditation. But this is a description of what goes on in meditation. Why don't we do this consciously in Zen? Why do they... will somebody tell me? I can tell you. But somebody tell me
Let's
why...
Let's talk
in,
about it at length.
Huh? Yeah. So this is why we don't. Why we don't talk about it at length is what? Is exactly the problem, isn't it?
Lots of words.
Because then instead of meditating, we're looking for gaps. We're judging. We're saying, oh, I'm on an 8 or 9. Will I ever get from 9 to 10? So in Zazen, you know, for 15 years, my teacher would never tell me anything about that stuff because he thought it would be more mind trips for me. But still, it is Buddhist psychology, and it can be helpful. So, you know, there's a middle way here, I think. Does that make sense? Anything else?